everybody. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for July 17th. Federal prosecutors declined to press charges against the New York City officer who killed Eric Garner 5 years ago, but that hasn't stopped the fight for Black lives.
Sometimes we have to, like, unweave the extent to which, like, we assume that if we are no longer paying attention to a thing, that the thing is no longer happening or going on.
We're talking about the state of Black activism across the country today.
I used to protest against police brutality when I was in school at Howard University all the time. Now that I'm older, I have a toddler right now. He's going to be growing up as a Black male in the United States, so I'll most likely be protesting again.
Also on the show, the patchwork of laws and faulty reasoning behind sex offender registries, and why the rumored 007 casting has left the internet shaken and stirred. For your eyes only, everyone, let's get it rolling. 5 years ago, the streets of New York City were full of the sounds of outrage and protest. The city was reacting to the killing of Eric Garner in Staten Island.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
I can't breathe! Denial!
We want it from the trial!
No indictment is denial!
We want it from the trial!
This is not just about Eric Garner. It's about all of us. It's about our collective humanity and what we as Americans are passing on to the next generation of Americans.
I'm disgusted and embarrassed by our New York City government and NYPD.
I was doing everything peacefully, but it's gotten to the point where
we gotta keep the peace.
It's wrong.
I know.
We all are hurt.
It's like, where are we headed for? What's the future for me?
Your system died right along with Eric Garner.
The man's life was taken for misdemeanor action. For selling cigarettes, loose cigarettes, you're gonna lose your life over that? Come on, it had to have been a better way.
It means people should respect the police officers even more so now, maybe out of fear, because it seems as we're becoming a police state.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
A now infamous video showed Eric Garner surrounded by police and yelling, "I can't breathe," 11 times while New York City police officer Daniel Pantaleo placed him in a chokehold. Garner then collapsed and died. Yesterday, the Department of Justice, under the direction of Attorney General Bill Barr, announced that it would not press federal charges against Officer Pantaleo.
I am very angry. I stand here in the spirit of my sister, who fought for justice until her dying day for my father, standing outside protesting. I'm going to stand outside and I'm going to scream it. Pantaleo needs to be fired. Eric died 7/17/14. 5 years later, and there's still no justice.
The anguish and pain of Emerald Garner, daughter of Eric Garner. She was responding yesterday to the news from the Department of Justice. Eric Garner's death was among the many high-profile killings of unarmed Black Americans that helped reignite Black activism nationwide and demands for police reform. But in those 5 years, while so much has changed, so much also hasn't.
It's absolutely not surprising to me that the criminal system of injustice is not giving any justice to the family of Eric Garner. It's not unintentional. This is kind of how the system was designed and points to the need for transformative approaches to engaging.
That's Malina Abdullah, the chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles, and a co-founder of the Los Angeles chapter of Black Lives Matter. She joined me along with Charlene Carruthers, a community organizer and founding national director of Black Youth Project 100, and Wesley Lowery, national reporter at The Washington Post, for a conversation about where we are today when it comes to the fight for Black lives.
5 years later, Gwen Carr, Eric Garner's mother, is still having to fight these legal and technical battles. And so these are processes that while we discuss, like, the macro, there's still, I think sometimes we make a mistake in forgetting the micro, that for individual families, they're still fighting the actual same battle, even as there's been some progress in at a bigger and a larger level.
Charlene, what about you? Is this where you thought we would be 5 years after Eric Garner?
The unfortunate reality is that this is a long, protracted struggle. And our generation or era of people who are fighting for Black liberation, we're not the first group to do it. We're not the first generation to do it. Our ancestors have been in this struggle now. And this marks even the 400th year. This marks the year of return for so many people who are descendants of the transatlantic slave trade back to the continent of Africa. And so we have to ground ourselves in that 5 years. While so much can happen in 5 years, we can see massive escalation in activity on the streets, both locally, regionally, and nationally, that it's 5 years within a long-term struggle. And when we're talking about, I'm going to lean into what Wesley just shared about the how it impacts folks on a very individual level, and talking about Eric Gardner's daughter and how she died at the age of 27 of a heart attack. And she was a young mother, a new mother at the time. And so the struggle for Black lives includes the ways in which our people experience violence in so many ways, from the state or the government, from corporations, and within our communities, and even within our own families. It's a wide web of what this fight is for.
We're having this conversation just hours after the news, as you mentioned, Wesley, of Eric Garner and prosecutors deciding not to charge the New York City police officer who killed him by chokehold. I'm curious, what does this mean for the broader fight for police accountability when it comes to the death of Black men and women?
Well, I think that when we think back 5 years, a lot of the conversation, and this wasn't a new conversation 5 years ago, but many of the people who became involved in it or who became mobilized by whether it be Eric Gardner's death or Michael Brown's death may have been new to the conversation. And certainly the like broad consciousness of this discussion reached people who otherwise hadn't been engaged. And so at the time, if you remember, there was a lot of conversation around, well, if the officers did anything wrong, then the system certainly is going to punish them, right? There was this assumption that the system and the processes worked to secure justice for Black and Brown people and for victims of police violence. And what we've seen now time and time again is that that's not how the system is structured. It's not a system that is built to bring police officers to any type of legal justice if and when they kill people. But I think that, and you know, I hear this as I talk to activists and organizers, and I'd be really interested to see what my like, fellow panelists think here, is that you can't make this conversation solely about whether or not criminal charges are brought against a police officer, right? Because again, as we know, the standard is so high and that these systems were not set up to bring these officers to justice, that time and time again, if that's what people are pushing for or working for, they're going to be disappointed and become either further, you know, become further disillusioned. And rather, there has to be a discussion about what justice looks like broadly and how, if under the current system, people are not receiving the outcomes that they think are fair and equitable, what is the new system that has to be constructed and what does that look like?
I heard some there. Who wants to weigh in?
We're not imagining that the system is going to bring justice. And it really does a disservice to the families who are directly impacted, as well as the memories of those who've been killed, to say, you know, we want justice for Ezell Ford, or we want justice for Trayvon Martin, because you can't get justice for them because their bodies have already been stolen, right? But what we are hoping for is that we'll transform the system in such a way that it'll mean that my son's life will be better protected. So it's important for us to uplift that families know that going in. Most of the families that we work with in Black Lives Matter, we have pretty candid conversations with them about the chances of officers even being prosecuted, let alone convicted. And so they're not really looking for that. Where I think justice comes from is in the struggle. And so this idea that we've always been in struggle, Black people have always struggled for our own liberation, there's a sense of justice that's earned by awakening ourselves to our own power. So when we think about what's happening in terms of the pushback and what we're seeing with this current administration, the surge in, they call it hate, but it's really white supremacist violence, right? Which is meted out both in rhetoric, policy, and actual physical violence, especially towards Black people, I think it reminds folks that we have to continue to rise up. And while we don't get the same media coverage that we got 5 or 6 years ago, we also have to recognize the tremendous will of the people in being willing to stand up and engage in lots of different ways.
I think perhaps one of the biggest, the most prominent memories of that I have was, Wesley, you and I being in Ferguson. Of course, I was there very briefly. You were there for extended amounts of time covering and are still covering the unraveling of the Michael Brown case years later. And part of what we witnessed there was boots on the ground, demonstrations, tear gas, rubber bullets. Are we not seeing that kind of activism anymore?
I actually think that there's a ton of activism that it looks like all types of different things, right? Even back then in 2014, 2015, it wasn't just the people in the streets, although mm-hmm. that certainly drew our attention, in us being the media and the country writ large. Although I will state that there certainly have been sizable demonstrations and protests that have happened in any number of cities very recently. But that said, I do think that sometimes we have to unweave the extent to which we assume that if we are no longer paying attention to a thing, that thing is no longer happening or going on, right? And so what we know to be true is that the police are still killing people, right? There are 3 fatal police shootings every single day in the United States of America. That's the exact same rate it was in 2014 and 2015 and 16 and 17 and 18. And so it's not as if racism in policing has been solved and there are no longer any issues within police use of force, right? What we know is that many of the organizations and activists and organizers who were doing the work in 2014 and 15 and 16 and got a ton of attention were doing that work before we had shown up to tell some of these stories, or before the shootings were being captured on cell phone video or being live tweeted, and that many of them are still, many of them in an additional set of folks are still doing that work now. And so I do think that, you know, we're living in a moment where we are dealing with a lot of distraction and noise that's coming out of Washington. I also think that I was just thinking about this yesterday, that so much of our conversation in the national media was framed around how President Obama, the first Black president, would handle these types of issues. And so that created a different staying power in the national conversation than there is in this moment, where there's the assumption that President Trump isn't going to do anything and certainly isn't going to come out and try to address things. But I also think that sometimes it speaks to how fickle we can be sometimes. When a police shooting does make it through and does get into kind of the national conversation, I get emails from readers who say, didn't we solve this already? Didn't we deal with this in 2014? There's the sense that we had a conversation and that conversation ended, that it had a bookend. But the reality is, this is a long-term grapple and a long-term struggle. And it's not something that all right, well, we all watched that one video and so we bought a mm-hmm. bunch of body cameras and now policing is fixed, right? This is something that has been a struggle that's been going on since the beginning of American policing, and is something that certainly wasn't fixed by 2 or 3 years of protest. And I don't think any of the organizers or activists or people in the streets thought it was going to be fixed in those individual moments.
Charlene, what's your assessment of the national attention, and specifically the media attention, on police killings of people of color, and specifically unarmed Black Americans?
Well, I agree with so much of what Wesley said, that the media is absolutely fickle when it comes to the stories that are actually, that the stories that receive attention. I can recall maybe one time a reporter ever asked to film a meeting, which is where we spend most of our time. We spend most of our time in planning meetings, figuring out what we're going to do. And the tip of the iceberg is the action that you may hear about that happens on the street. Underneath that are a series of strategy meetings, meals, conversations, relationship building. All kinds of work happens outside of what people see on the street.
Melina, I want to step back for a moment, because I remember attempting to pitch a story early on about Black Lives Matter and its importance, and sort of being shut down very early on in the movement's birth, if you will. And here we are years later. When we think about where Black Lives Matter as a movement is today, how would you assess it?
Thinking about Black Lives Matter, so we were born July 13th, 2013, right here in Los Angeles, and we've been engaging ever since. we are getting, you know, very little media coverage. But I think in cities like Los Angeles, we've really grown. And we have demonstrations at least 3 times a week. And as Charlene lifted up, the demonstrations are only the tip of the iceberg. We have had an impact on how our community is policed. If we think about the numbers, yes, people are still being killed by police. However, in the cities where we have the most active Black Lives Matter chapters and the most active organizing work, we've seen numbers drop. So in Los Angeles, at the start of Black Lives Matter, there were over 20 people being killed each year by police, by LAPD. And now we're down to about 7 or 8 folks being killed a year. Now, that's not justice. Justice would mean no killings at the hands of LAPD. But it is an impact.
I want to ask both Charlene and Melina if you can weigh in on this. I mean, we talked a little bit. Charlene, you brought up Erica Garner's death, untimely death in her 20s. And I think this is part of a bigger conversation about fatigue, exhaustion, if you will, in the movement and particularly among activists who are front and center trying to do these direct actions. And Melina, you faced even criminal charges as a result of your activism because of that. I mean, what toll does that take on the movement or movements as a whole?
And thinking about how individual people are impacted by this, people have to know the scale at which people are impacted. It's not just the most visible leaders. It is our folks who are in chapters across the country. BYP 100 is in 4 states in the South, in the Midwest, and on the East Coast as well. And our local leaders. Our local leaders carry so much of the burden of the work on a day-to-day basis. And it's absolutely exhausting work. And we are working under capitalism. We are working under anti-Blackness and working under systems of patriarchy. And so we have to do the work to always tell as big of stories as possible about what's happening on the ground. And those stories have to include the dozens, hundreds of people who are moving this work. And so I think one of the reasons why you don't see people in the streets in the same way every single day now is because people are choosing to and being required to do their work differently, because it takes a toll on your physical, mental, and spiritual self. And for those of us who have decided that this is a lifetime commitment, we have to understand that it is not a sprint. And frankly, it's not just a marathon where we just keep going. If anything, it may be a relay race. It may be a way to think about it, where we're like the baton is passed back and forth through many people as we go along the journey. And so we have to make those types of commitments to actualizing what some people will call healing justice in our movements as we develop strong leaders to do this work, because it goes beyond any individual's lifetime, and the individual also matters in the work.
I want to pivot for a second because we are running short on time here, but we are heading into a very contentious election season. We've been in a very contentious political cycle now for quite some time. I recall going into the 2016 election, candidates, particularly Democratic candidates, were talking a lot about even using the language of Black Lives Matter in particular. I'm not hearing similar language so far. It's still very early in the debates. There's still 20 some odd candidates. But I'm wondering, Wesley, as you cover these movements and as we look ahead to 2020, is the tone different? Are the presidential candidates addressing these specific issues as they relate to Black Americans?
Well, I think the conversation has shifted. I do think that a wide array of candidates have adapted language and positions that were unthinkable even 4 or 5 years ago, and that there is credit to the activists and organizers who've done that. So when you think about 2016, there was a massive like rhetorical fight over whether or not like Hillary Clinton would even say the words Black Lives Matter. And now you have presidential candidates rolling out plans for racial reparations, right? We live in a completely different world than we did 4 or 5 years ago. You had a candidate in Julian Castro invoke specifically the crisis facing Black trans women. You have people like Elizabeth Warren who are talking specifically about maternal mortality rates among Black women, right? These are conversations that are, and talking points and policy issues that have been adapted specifically from young Black organizers. And again, there's a level of specificity there where you have three or four or five candidates out there with specific policing plans, when previously it would have been considered like radical and hyper-liberal and progressive to even admit that perhaps the police needed to change or something needed to be different. And so I think that the last few years of movement have unquestionably changed the way certainly Democratic candidates, but I would argue even some Republican candidates, talk about these issues at all, and the depth to which they engage those issues. And it's hard to, sometimes it's hard to remember how far we've come as it relates to those things. And so that gets lost sometimes. I mean, is that enough? Is it, you know, I don't think it's like, I don't think this is something that's static. Well, all right, you've checked the right box, you've said the right thing, and so therefore you can stop caring about Black people or brown people or about activist movements. Like, there's always going to be pressure, and that pressure is always going to force folks to consider things they haven't otherwise. But I think that when you look at the 2020 election cycle and the 2016 election cycle, we live in a world that is far beyond where it was at the time, and that's because of the way so many activists and organizers have been able to begin shifting and changing this conversation.
Wesley Lowery is a national reporter at The Washington Post. Charlene Carruthers is a community organizer and founding national director of Black Youth Project 100. And Melina Abdullah is chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles, and a co-founder of the Los Angeles chapter of Black Lives Matter. Thanks to you all for this robust and interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, my name is Janelle, calling from Miami, and I used to protest against police brutality when I was in school at Howard University, and we used to protest all the time. We even once witnessed an undercover cop shoot a man. Now that I'm older, I have a toddler right now, so my protests now are used for social media. That's as much as I can do right now until my toddler grows up. He's going to be growing up as a Black male in the United States, so I'll most likely be protesting again until things change.
This is Andrea Hollingsworth. I'm calling from Lancaster, Texas. I had never participated in this type of a protest, but I was inspired by my 16-year-old daughter, who basically said we can't sit on the sidelines when these types of things are happening.
I did not protest actively until about 2 years ago. Since then, I've been working with an organization in Tacoma that helps formerly incarcerated people return to life outside. And from those people, I have learned the gut-wrenching stories of what it is like to be Black in American cities, particularly when the police are involved.
This is Lorna Lynn calling from Wynwood, Pennsylvania. I participated in a march for Black Lives Matter in a nearby suburb of Philadelphia a few years ago. This was well organized and respectful. Local police were in attendance to help with blocking off traffic. Many of us took time to thank the police for being there. My sense was that these police officers were troubled by the violent behavior that others in their profession had shown towards Black citizens.
Hi, my name is Alita. I'm calling from Normal, Illinois. I am a 57-year-old white woman. I have lobbied for a local citizens advisory board to bridge the gap between citizens and the local police force. My book group has read White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo and other books about the history of civil rights and racism in the U.S. I follow the Twitter accounts of Black writers, artists, scholars, and politicians because I want to know their perspectives. In conversations with other white people, I try to explain and transmit what I keep learning from Black thinkers and activists.
This is The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.
There are currently more than 900,000 people on sex offender registries across the country, and that number is growing. A new report from the Huffington Post shows a patchwork of laws, from public urination to possession of child pornography to violent sexual crime, can land someone on the list for life. And some studies show that registries don't always reduce recidivism or prevent sex crimes, and laws restricting where offenders can find housing and employment can keep people on the fringes of society for life. At the same time, as more high-profile cases of sexual assault and abuse continue to make headlines, the need for protections of vulnerable communities remain. Guy Hamilton Smith is here to talk through this all. He's a legal fellow for the Sex Offense Litigation and Policy Resource Center at the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. Guy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a complicated issue. It's you know, we can look at this. There's so many ways to really try to understand this. So let's start with the very beginning. Why was the sex offender registry created? What was the initial intention behind it?
Well, I mean, the initial intention behind sex offense registries was to, you know, prevent sexual harm from occurring, and they really sort of developed in the wake of high-profile offenses against children in the early and mid-1990s, difficult cases that sort of demanded a response. They were developed, and then they rolled out very quickly thereafter with federal legislation in the mid-1990s, as well as state legislation, and very quickly all 50 states adopted their own version of sex offense registries.
And how has the registry evolved over the years? Has it gotten more restrictive, or has it expanded to include potential crimes that weren't included in the original iteration?
Yes. They originally sort of began more or less just as lists of people who've been convicted of some crime. But the modern form of registries is that they function more as kind of like a sort of shadow parole where you have a maze of restrictions and regulations that people on these lists have to abide by or else risk returning to prison. And they have also expanded in terms of what offenses will put people on registries. States have also adopted other types of criminal offense registries, such as, you know, drug offenses, white-collar crime offenses. So they are sort of broadening both in terms of scope and complexity, as well as the number of people on them. The most recent count from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children is that there are now almost a million people who are on these public registries.
So let's talk about what kinds of crimes can actually get someone on a sex offender registry. And we know that there's a sort of patchwork of different rules and laws across the country. But what's the range here, Guy?
Well, the range is really quite broad. When we're talking about these registries, we're really talking about, you know, 50-plus different registries with 50-plus different sets of rules and 50-plus different sets of crimes that will, you know, wind people up getting on them. And so you have the obvious sort of candidates for what you would anticipate, such as rape or sexual assault or child molestation are obviously offenses that will put people on sex offense registries. But also you have, you know, offenses that are non-sexual in nature, where people get put on sex offense registries and have to comply with all these rules, such as there was a recent case out of the Southern District of New York where a federal court ordered someone to come off of registry conditions on his parole because he had been convicted of kidnapping a minor, but it was gang-related, had nothing to do with sex, but he was still ordered to register and comply with New York sex offense registry laws because it was a kidnapping of a minor, which the statute said you had to register for. So there's really a wide swath of different sorts of offenses and different sorts of crimes that can get people onto registries. And the essential reason for that is that, you know, dangerousness is not really a consideration for registration. It's just whether or not someone has been convicted of any kind of a crime.
Guy, what evidence do we have that sex offender registries help to reduce recidivism and actually prevent sex crimes and or protect the people who, as we mentioned earlier, who these laws were initially meant to protect, children?
Well, we all certainly care about preventing sexual harm and holding people accountable for harm that they've committed. But the evidence is that this entire field of law and policy that seeks to do that is not really reflective of the reality of sexual harm. In many ways, makes sexual harm more, not less likely. The research that's been done into the effectiveness of these registries has generally concluded that they are not effective at reducing recidivism. And in fact, that recidivism rates for people convicted of sex offenses are actually much lower than is commonly believed. And that's, you know, supported by even the government's own data. In fact, research that's been done suggests that these registries actually make crime more likely by essentially making it impossible for people who have been held accountable for a criminal offense to then reintegrate into their communities and live, you know, healthy and productive lives, which is, you know, what we should want. I mean, essentially what these registries do is they misdirect our resources and attention into focusing on instances of sexual harm that are not, that aren't really reflective of the reality of sexual harm in our society. For instance, 95% of all reported sex offenses are attributable to first-time offenders, so people who are not on a registry. So to the extent that we are using these registries as a means of keeping our community safe, we're essentially missing almost all sexual violence.
I do want to ask one thing here, because I think one of the things that when we talk about the range of crimes that could leave us, that could put someone on a sex offender registry, there have been, you know, the range is often, you know, sex crimes and rape and other very serious crimes. And then it goes to something like public urination, which I'm sure most Americans would agree is, you know, the public urination thing is probably not something worthy of putting someone on a sex offender registry for life. But there is this idea that, you know, I mean, to be honest, if I or someone I knew had been the victim of a sex crime, particularly if that person was a child, I would not want to have that person reintegrated into my neighborhood, my society in a lot of ways. And I think there has to be, you know, what is the middle ground here? You know, is there a way to make sure that these behaviors are both criminalized and taken care of versus, you know, criminalizing every single person that, you know, within this wide range that we've been talking about? It just feels like, you know, it can't be a black or white situation, right?
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really important that we hold people accountable, you know, for harm that they cause, you know, for crimes that they commit. And that's why we have the criminal legal system. And the criminal legal system certainly isn't perfect, obviously. But that is the system that we have for, you know, holding people accountable, and they serve their sentence. And I think that's absolutely a good thing. But on the, you know, these registries, they all come into play, you know, after someone has served their time, after someone has been held accountable. You know, the thing is that, you know, to the extent that people who are reintegrating after being held accountable for some offense succeed, then we all succeed, because that's less crime. That's more people in their communities who are having productive lives and who are raising their own families and who are contributing to our society. And this issue also speaks to how these registries have sort of become confused in the public consciousness. They're supposed to be about public safety, but the way that they're implemented and the way that they are, you know, the way that they don't really reflect evidence-based practices indicates that they're really about punishment. And if we want them to be about punishment versus public safety, you know, I think that we can decide that's what we want as a society. But I think that we ultimately have to, you know, sort of confront the reality that these laws are not effective at producing public safety, and then we can decide where to go from there.
So let's talk about one of the reasons this is even in the national conversation again is because I think in some part we're watching the Jeffrey Epstein trial unfold, and Epstein has a long history of being a sexual predator to girls, and including rape and other alleged sex acts that he's committed. And he was on a sex offender registry. And that did not seem to do, at least on the surface, did not seem to prevent him from living the life that he was living. Now, part of that is because Epstein is wealthy. And my question is, if you are not wealthy, what then?
Well, I mean, I think the Epstein case, you know, reflects a reality of our broader criminal legal system, but also when it comes to the application of sex offense registries, is that if you are someone who has resources and connections, then you have a very different experience than people without. You know, so what I hope comes out of this Epstein case is a more serious interrogation of sexual harms, because as you noted, you know, whether he was on the registry or not, like that didn't really seem to have much impact on what his behavior was. But the reality is that these laws don't really have much impact on what anyone's behavior are. And so, like I said, I hope that this just leads to a deeper interrogation of sexual harm in our society.
Guy Hamilton Smith is a legal fellow for the Sex Offense Litigation and Policy Resource Center at the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. Guy, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
The name is Lynch, Lashana Lynch. She's the British actress who's rumored to be the new 007 in the next James Bond movie. Lynch would be the first woman and black actor to assume the mantle of 007. You might recognize Lynch from her recent role in Captain Marvel as the superhero's best friend and fighter pilot Maria Rambeau. Now, Lynch won't actually be playing the historically white and male James Bond. Daniel Craig will still be in that role, but Lynch's character will reportedly take over his iconic secret agent number when he retires to Jamaica. It's a surprising, but some would say welcome move, especially in a franchise where misogyny has been a secondary character for decades.
Dink, meet Felix Leiter.
Hello.
Felix, say hello to Dink.
Hi, Dink.
Dink, say goodbye to Felix.
Hmm?
Man talk.
Here to talk about the new 007 and the broader issues of diverse casting in Hollywood is Hunter Harris, a staff writer at New York Magazine's Vulture. Welcome to The Takeaway, Hunter.
Thank you.
So what do you make of this casting choice in the new Bond?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I guess I'm a little bit excited. I mean, I have been a James Bond fan for a long time, but obviously it is a franchise that's mired in a lot of sexism, a lot of racism. I mean, it just seems very antiquated generally and has for, you know, so many years now. But the Daniel Craig, you know, sort of era of James Bond movies has been a little bit more progressive. And so I think this is kind of the perfect way to end his arc of movies by, you know, sort of passing the baton to a woman, to a person of color, and bring a lot more diversity into, you know, a very historically white, conservative franchise.
And as you mentioned, there's been a lot of misogyny in this. Let's talk a little bit about how women have been treated throughout the franchise. I mean, just thinking about the Bond films, you think about there's always the beautiful or multiple beautiful women who are, you know, flanking Bond, right?
Right.
So how would that play out here?
You know, I don't know. I am excited, though, that there is a woman, Phoebe Waller-Bridge from Fleabag, who is, and also Killing Eve, who's writing the script. And I believe that she is only the second woman to have a credited script credit on a Bond film. But I really trust Phoebe Waller-Bridge's vision, and I think that she is kind of the perfect person to bring women into the center of these movies and not just as arm candy, not just as, you know, a woman who's kind of grinning and just looks very beautiful, kind of, you know, on the side. I mean, even the clip we just heard is like astonishing how disgusting that is. It really grosses me out. And it's far overdue for a woman to be driving these movies and not just sort of, you know, the woman who is just shown as kind of collateral damage.
Right. And when we think about, we're getting a little bit into the whole issue of diverse casting in Hollywood in a minute, but like, what do we think the idea is behind this casting outside of just diversity? I mean, is the Bond franchise needing to skew younger at this point, needing to expand to different audiences?
I think there are a lot of things happening. Definitely, it needs to expand to different audiences for sure, because, you know, it's been a while since the last Bond movie. And also, as I said before, I mean, and this is like not a secret, that Daniel Craig has been wanting out of this for a while because it is a very physically taxing role. And, you know, there has been a movement, I think, in the past 5 years to get Idris Elba to get to play James Bond.
Yes, I know. There are some who are quite disappointed in that casting choice. I'm not going to mention any names, but yes.
You and me, and I'm sure everyone else with taste. So I think that, you know, Bond needs sort of an infusion of new life for sure. But also behind the scenes, the people who produce James Bond are, you know, very conservative and very, and by conservative, I mean in terms of taste. And they really are very protective of the James Bond legacy. But at the same time, they're partnering with, you know, sort of an upstart, more independent studio, Annapurna, which did, you know, movies like 20th Century Women, If Beale Street Could Talk, Vice from last year. So I think that just generally, we are getting a lot of new blood in this James Bond. In addition to Phoebe Waller-Bridge, as I said, Cary Fukunaga is, you know, a really exciting Asian-American director who is taking on this movie. So I think across the board, both in front of the camera and behind the scenes, we're seeing a lot of interesting choices being made.
There is another interesting casting choice, if you will, not in the world of spies, but this time in the underground, undersea, right?
Yes.
Under the sea. We're talking here Little Mermaid casting Ariel for the first time with a black actress in the lead here. Now, I saw some of the quote-unquote backlash on social media. Mm-hmm. Hunter, was this real or was it like just social media brouhaha? Like, what was the reaction to this whole hashtag not my Ariel?
I think it was a little bit of social media brouhaha, I have to say. You know, that happens all the time where the, you know, a dozen people can just feel like the most deafening sound in the room on the internet. But at the same time, what was really kind of heartening to see is the number of women of color, Black women, who were so excited by this, like by this idea that, you know, one of the most beautiful and most exciting and most interesting Disney princess characters is going to be a Black girl. I mean, I'm very excited by that. And also, I do just really stan Chloe and Halle. They're like music. And so I'm very excited about this.
And this would really be the first time, right, that, or maybe the second time that Disney has a Black woman character at the center of one of its films.
Yes. I mean, definitely the first time that would be for one of these live action adaptations, which, you know, make so much money and have such a huge imprint. We can see that with, you know, Aladdin, Dumbo, you know, The Lion King coming up. So I think that we should be really excited because this is a great way just for a young Black actor to have a huge platform and really be catapulted the center of this.
There's been a little bit of mentioning brouhaha. One of the actresses, one of the best paid actresses in Hollywood, Scarlett Johansson, made some comments this week that she should be able to, and I'm paraphrasing here, play any role that she wants, any animal or tree or whatever. She's kind of tried to walk that back a little bit, but it was talking about quote-unquote politically correct casting here. What was your reaction to her comments there?
I don't know what she is talking about. Play any person, character, or tree. I'm sorry, but no, ma'am. That is just completely the wrong way of thinking about this. My, you know, the Scarlett Johansson casting controversies that have come up in the past are her playing, I believe, an Asian manga character. And then also she was cast to play a trans person and then eventually pulled out of that film. But I mean, my initial reaction to anything like that is just to listen and not to speak and to hear what the people who are part of these communities think of your decisions. And if they have a problem with it, then don't do it. And I really, you know, wish that she would take more time to consider the feelings of people who are upset and not just have a very, you know, kind of curt reactionary response that's just, I can say anything I want because art is what we're after here. And I mean, sure, but not in this way.
Well, let's talk about that. And because I do think it's important to talk about this idea of colorblind casting, right? And mm-hmm. when I think about that, I think one of the biggest examples for me was watching Hamilton, you know, on Broadway and just seeing the George Washington and other performers who happened to be performers of color, right? And that didn't seem to be the main thrust of the performance. So how close are we really, Hunter, to colorblind casting? I mean, is that a possibility in the future?
I think it's a possibility in the future for sure. I think audiences are ready for it, but it's really if studios, if executives, if, you know, producers, directors are willing to take the chance. And so many times it's been proven over and over again that movies starring people of color travel internationally, that they make their money back, that they are financially and culturally successful. But it's, you know, it's the onus is on those people to hire people of color and to really, you know, not feel so bound to the existing intellectual property, to the fan base, whatever, and just cast whoever is best and make sure that people of color are getting in these rooms and getting auditions.
Hunter Harris is a staff writer at New York Magazine's Vulture. Hunter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.